I'm pretty impressed that it was a full house before even the doors had to close. I normally have to direct people, which is... And it's about a boring subject, so I don't know what quite to make about you guys. Thank you for coming. Now that I've insulted you, we can get on
with it.
I just thought I'd get rid of the tomatoes first.
It was lesser of the evils.
Yeah, thanks for that, guys. I did give this presentation in Tallinn, Estonia, a few weeks back. At that time, there was no other choice, because there was one stream, and I was the guy. So I had a fair few people in that one as well, and we actually managed to have a bit of a laugh, so hopefully we can make that happen now as well. So, making code maintainable, reusable, and readable. So you can have maintainable code, but not readable code. I'm going to show you how what we've done with TDD. We embraced it a few weeks back to see what it'd be like, because I was tired of fixing the stuff that I'd fixed before. Fixed again. How many times has someone heard, "I thought we'd fix that"? Yeah, well, this will stop that from happening. So it takes all the fun out. Okay, a little bit about me. I've been a fairly old man on the block, been around a bit. We specialise in OO design and code refactoring, because when I look at my code from a month ago or 5 months ago, I always think, damn, I could have done that better. And I think we all do. I mean, there's some code out there that's been 10, 15, 20 years sometimes. And you think, what was I smoking when I wrote that? Because... favorite tale I've got to do is when I was writing a new application once, I wanted to make sure that it was completely dynamic so I could add a new database table and the code would still work. All that magic stuff. So I spent ages writing this wonderful piece of code. I mean, it was truly magnificent. It finished up on the Friday. By Monday morning, I had no idea what it meant to do because it was too clever. And then there is a saying by Kernighan, I think it is, that says, if you write code to the best of your abilities, debugging it is twice as hard. Therefore, you will never be able to fix it. And it's something we should write. You should write the code to make it as simple as possible, not as clever as possible. So, the whole point of test-driven development is that you write the tests first, before you write code. Yeah, that's the sort of reception I got last time. Stunned silence, you what? It's obviously different from traditional development methods. And the second point on that, it takes buy-in from all involved. That's the most important thing you can take from this. You have to make sure that everybody buys into this. Because there's no point in managers saying, develop tests first, and the program going, nah. Well, there's no point in the programmer going, I'm going to write tests first, and the manager goes, where's your code? So you've got to have buy-in on all levels. It's not easy. It really isn't. I struggled. I really did struggle with it, so I'm not going to make this sort of walk in the park. You have to think completely differently from most developments, from where you guys actually do your development. It is hard to make the switch. Don't. It is going to be really, really hard. I still struggle with it now. If I need to fix something quickly, I'll just, no, I mustn't. Who does test-driven development? Anyone? Ah, cool, so you've got some idea of the pain that you're going to go through in this slide, okay.
Is there a difference between, I'm assuming there's a difference between a test versus what, you know, we would have called for years, you know, user specification? I mean, is how would you... compare those two?
You write the tests according to the user specification and then write your code to pass the tests.
Okay.
Because that way you are testing just what the customer has specified and you're not writing extra code. Now, we'll show you a good example of that just now. This isn't new stuff. This has been around since 1989. So let's get with the program people. 1994, extreme programming, which is like the run stuff that all modern people are now doing. 2004,
ProUnit. ProUnit is a progress-based testing framework. 10 years ago, this stuff appeared in the open source. So it is nothing magic, it's nothing new. OEUnit came out in 2010, which is another test framework for progress. And 20, are there any progress people there are? Yeah. I believe, from the roadmap that we were shown on Monday, that there are some unit testing framework thing coming along, maybe. Standard disclaimers apply, because that's what was on the slides. So we have a choice of actually three frameworks. So again, you know, highly unusual for Probe's marketplace. We actually have a choice of stuff. So what's our traditional development cycle? We write code. We run tests. Anyone? So, everyone does that one, yeah? We think. I mean,
first is figure out what we need.
This is development. This isn't specification. This is development. This is what we do. Any dumb managers in here doing specs? Right. So, as developers, we can write this code, and we have to write the code to the best of our abilities. And then we run tests, don't we, guys? Yeah, we do run tests.
They compile.
That was my development cycle. Yes, it compiles. Ship it. You occasionally pick on a user. You doing UAT. User acceptance testing. Oh man, why me? Deploy. Fix bugs. Because the second we deploy, someone goes, oh no, that's not working, or that's not what I wanted, or I noticed
that's
I said
not
bugs.
A bug. That's not a bug.
It is according to the user.
I don't care.
So we have that. Yes, a raucous crowd. Yeah. TDD cycle, we write tests, we run tests, we have to write the code to make the test pass, because there is no code to start off with, we run more tests, we fix bugs, we refactor. Now what I mean by the refactoring is, as you're writing your code, if you're doing it this way, you'll suddenly find that you're duplicating some stuff, because that's the way it is. And therefore, what you can do, once you've had your tests, if you refactor the code by taking out duplicates or moving into different functions or something like that, if all the tests pass, you haven't broken anything. You could refactor a whole chunk of stuff and it hasn't broken, and you know it hasn't broken because all your tests pass. Now that's, you've got to put that in context, is if you write one test that goes, does A equal 1? Yep, it passes, ship it. It's not going to quite work. And we do that in the cycle. We go round and round and round. And at some stage, we'll decide to deploy. Now, that decision can be made by someone else. So as coders, we're just going round and fixing things and making them better and faster and smarter. But because we have our tests, we have a higher confidence factor that these are going to actually work. So the CDD cycle, red, green, refactor, ready, steady, go type stuff. All unit tests, like JUnit, like all the other testing frameworks out there, they highlight in red that something's failed, they highlight in green that something's passed. That's why it's red, green, and then refactor. So we made the code better to maintain and test, which means that if your code is incredibly complicated, it is very, very difficult to write proper tests. So if you write your tests first and write the code to match the tests, your code is very simple and easy to understand because you're following what your needs are at the time or what the requirements are at the time. I need to be able to multiply two numbers together. And here's the result. So you don't write code that divides two numbers just in case somebody may want it sometime in the future. Unless you're paid by lines of code. That's up to you guys. The refactoring is a very, very important part of this. One of the things I was doing with a product I was rewriting from scratch, I was showing my partner this bit of code, and this bit didn't work. So I hadn't written a test for it, and I'd written code without writing the test. And of course, that bit failed. It had to fail, and he went, "Ha! You wrote code without writing your tests." Damn right. So I thought, do you know what? I know how to fix this. I can just put that bit of code in, and it'll fix the problem. And I thought, oh, I must do this right. I must suck it up. Spend the time to write the test, and then I know it's going to fail. So I've got a test that I know is going to fail because I know there's a bug in the program. But the more I looked at this, I thought, do you know what, that bit comes from the wrong place, and that library's in the wrong place. And I was able to refactor it, and now I've got a library that I can use in all my other applications because I took the time to look at it rather than just fixing a little bug. So what happens with the red cycle? We write a test for a class or method, or procedure, or internal procedure, or user-defined function, or whatever. I talk OO, so. You write a test for a class or method that doesn't exist, or for a new requirement, and the test will fail. We know this because in progress you can't define a class that doesn't exist yet. So the very fact of writing the test, your test won't compile. So the first thing you do is write the class. Then you try and write the test for the method. But that will fail. And everyone's going, why would we go through all of this? It makes you think of the functionality that you're testing. And it makes you think or write the code that is required to pass the test. I will stress this and keep stressing this throughout. Only write the code that you need. Because this is slowing you up anyway. You really don't want to double your development cycle by putting in code that you don't want. Well, sorry, but you think that they might want it. Because I can guarantee you they won't want it. I've been a very conceited, clever programmer. When ActiveX first came out in version 8 and they had all these wonderful GUI tools that you could have tabs and all this sort of stuff. My application, I obviously redesigned because it was GUI, and I thought I'd be clever and let every user be able to define their own user interface. So they could define their own tabs. They could define what fields they wanted on which tabs, they could define the size, the layout, customized to your heart's content. I set them up with a template, and 4 years later, not one bugger had changed one thing. Because it was just what they wanted. So I was able to remove something like 10 or 15,000 lines of code. To manage the widgets, to position them, to access the database and populate screen value. And then just to find the frame and find information displayed. 3 lines of code, done. If I'd been writing unit tests for that sort of functionality, I never would have written all that code because the user didn't want it. I just wrote it from my own ego and vanity. So, dream. Write just enough code to make the test pass. It passes. It's the most difficult part of the whole TDD cycle. Writing just enough code. So let's have a look at this. We'll take this example. Someone has defined that they want a new method, which, given an integer value of 42, returns false. Okay, meaningless to use a spec. We're all used to that, aren't we? So what's enough code to make this test pass? Here we go. My method, A is int. If A is 42, then return false. Not return true.
It didn't say that in the spec.
It didn't say that in the spec. We are assuming that the user wants true if it's not 42. No, not necessarily. The requirement stated should only be for 42. All other values are undetermined. No requirement, no test. You only write a test for your requirements. Then if it fails, you can say, wasn't in the spec. And you are protected as developers because you wrote the spec. Yeah, I'll play it.
We're never protected.
In
that case, since the default value of a logical is false, all you got to do is have a function that does nothing.
Yeah.
Because it'll always be false.
I've got a horrible feeling I've written too much code in the next slide. Yeah, this dent in my forehead is from an angry user once. So, thanks, I've written too much code! The default function is to return false, of course, with the method, so, yeah, thanks for that.
Sorry about that.
There's a smart guy. So that's the minimum amount of code required to pass this test. So there's at least one more requirement. What happens if it's not 42? So the developer now should liaise with other stakeholders. I wrote this business guy. Are you needing different results for other numbers, Mr. Testament? Go back to the guy, ask him. Don't write the code, change the requirements. Because then it's documented that this is what they wanted, rather than assumptions. It's also called CYA coding. So we then write tests for the new requirements. Moving on to refactoring. We refactor to make it more maintainable, more readable, and good code quality. Again, you guys are in a programming job for a certain period of time, and hopefully, or really unwillingly, you'll move positions or you change around, or God help you, you become managers. You are leaving a legacy behind you. And I would far rather someone looks at my code and goes, wow, hey, this guy was cool, he knew what he was doing. How many times do you know that? Or do you read that and go, what a pile of, I need to rewrite this. Because you can't understand it. If you make your code maintainable, if you make it easy to read, you not only help the poor slob that's following you, you also help yourself because people aren't coming back to you all the time and saying, what were you doing here? And you need to look at that and go, make a guess. Because you will get found out. Your unit tests help you check that you don't break functionality. Again, this is an important thing, because if you make a bug fix, because you know there's a bug, you write a new test to check for that bug, you then fix that bug and your test passes. If one of your other tests failed, you've broken something by trying to fix this thing. Now, I don't know about you, but again, that happens to me all the time. Because you think, oh, that variable's not used anywhere, or that method isn't used, you take it out because you're refactoring outside the spec. Then of course you break something somewhere else. Your unit tests will help you catch that and stop you from being a laughing stock or an embarrassment. DRY, don't repeat yourself. If you have any code that is duplicated, it is bad. It's bad code. Because if there's a bug in it, you'll have to fix it twice. And no, the answer is not include files. Do not use include files. Make it hard to read your code. So again, as you're coding, if you're starting to smell that you've got this pattern already in the code somewhere, if you're, I'm sure I've done this before, who does cut and paste programming? It's not a good idea. It's quick, it's simple, and it leads to long-term problems. So don't do it. If you find yourself cutting and pasting, refactor, change some things, because your unit test will help you fix that. So the benefits are quite clear. We ensure quality code from the very beginning. It promotes loosely coupled code. Hey, I'm starting to get into Peter's presentations here. Gotcha. Loosely coupled means that you don't have to always join things exactly like that. If you start building libraries, they become reusable by all sorts of things. Your specifications, if unfortunately you're told to write some code and you don't have any specs, if you write good tests, they can be your specification, because you can read the tests and understand what this test in this module is meant to do, and therefore you can actually work out what the specification was. So you can have some responsibility yourself for that. And it gives you confidence that your code works, which is always a good thing. I'm going to make this code out there, and I'm not going to be crossing my fingers this time and crossing my toes and making sure I have to do it on a bank holiday or something like that. If it's gone through all the testing and it then still fails, then either there's something wrong with the spec or you haven't tested it. Or the code is too complicated. One of the most difficult things, now again, I was way into this dynamic programming because it was cool, it was really hip and trendy. And I ran stuff based on data from the database, and there is not a hope in hell you can debug that. Because some, are there any customers here? Some idiot customer will put something into the database that you don't know. Swear to God that he hasn't touched it, and you will spend months trying to find this problem. And then find, sorry. So try not to do dynamic coding, because it's very, very difficult to test all the paths, all the routes through your code. Because if you run value, that's a great one. Because what's the value of this variable? I don't know. So there's not a hope in hell you can test that. Because unless it's a very, very restrictive amount of data, try not to, basically. Keeps unused code out of your system. Again, the amount of time that I've been patching this one program, because I've been doing it, I've been changing the main table, and this one quite complicated program, I have to keep updating and grading it. And there's only 7 years later I found no one was using it. So I've been maintaining something that didn't need to be maintained. Try and keep your code out of the system that is not used, that you don't use. Makes you think about application design. It makes you sit down and think, because if I'm going to write a test for this, we'll come on to what's called solid principles in a couple of slides. But what it makes you do is really concentrate on the design of your application to say, well, if I do this, then I probably really need to, and that's what the tests make you do. Also helps you find bugs really quickly. Who's debugged? View as. Message hash 1, view as. Message hash 2, view as. And you get 1, oh, didn't get 2. That's where the bug is. If you ran it in unit tests, you'd know exactly where it was, because your unit test would fail. Bang. And something like OU, it will tell you, because you'll say, well, this test failed. You know, it's that method or that procedure in this class or that persistent procedure. So there's a huge amount of benefits. You might not see that in the back, but basically this is the cost of bugs. This company reckon that to fix in coding is X. You know, it's the cost of the programmer, I found it, I'll fix it, it's your X. After you complete, a bug in the code and code fix begins to impact other developers, it's sort of like 5 times. If one of your programs fails, another programmer might be spending 2 or 3 hours trying to figure out why his bit of code's not working to find out that it's not his code. It's your code that's buggy. And so on and so forth. And they reckon it can cost up to 1,000 times more to fix a bug in production. Especially if it causes a customer down situation or like all the QAD databases, some will go out of sync because the data's been corrupted or whatever. It's a huge cost. And as a business, you should invest upfront in testing to stop that sort of cost. So, why do we need to fix bugs properly? Basically, yeah, our goal is to write bug-free software. I'll pay a $10 bonus for every bug you find and fix. We're rich, yes. That's the one I love. I'm going to write me a minivan. So no, we're taking this away, guys. I'm sorry, you can't write your minivans anymore. But I hope this drives the right behavior. So what you might want to consider is actually, well, no, actually, there are no managers here, so I'm not going to suggest what I was going to suggest. So we have code coverage as well. Code coverage makes sure that all the bits of your code are tested. You could ship something out right now into production, and two out of the three methods you might never call. You just don't know. Whereas if you've written unit tests, then you know that each part of the library or the application or anything like that has been covered. Now, who's at Gilles' SermonQ presentation? You should speak to him about that, because the code coverage is a tool that shows you all sorts of things about progress code. How many times this line's been executed. It's a really cool tool. You get regression testing for free. You fix a bug, and all your tests work, and everyone's happy. There are no regressions. As I said earlier about recurring bugs. Well, I thought I fixed that. Yeah, you did, and something else. And that was in version 2, and now you've got a version 3 branch. You've decided to abandon the version 3 branch, 2 branch, and you've merged version 2 back in, and something bugs back there. Gives you a clean API design. As I said, it promotes better coding. Reduced debugging, and reduced development costs. Not in the short term. It's going to cost you more in the short term. To ramp up speed, it's more of a time spend initially. And this is where you need to buy it. Because if your managers don't understand that it's going to take you longer to write this stuff, then you're not going to be able to do it. So, as I've said, I developed a new product recently. And what we decided to do was write it from scratch completely, because I messed it up, the first three versions. So version 4 is leaner, cleaner, meaner. And we rewrote it completely from scratch. And one of the things we decided to do is not take a single line of code from this old product. And we're going to rewrite it from scratch. It took us 3 weeks, including writing the unit tests. And the most horrible part of this is that we actually found more bugs in the progress engine than we did in the application. They were all reported and all fixed in level 4. I'm pleased with it. And I have to say, I know this is because it's true, the tech support department, when I reported these, I gave them the use case, and I could give them the use case because my tests were failing. So I knew exactly how to reproduce this. Shipped it out to tech support, they went, yep, thank you, reproduced, out to tech, whatever it was, and within a day or two, fixed. Or it will be fixed in level 4. So the guys at Progress have been doing a great job in fixing these bugs. If they can, if I just said, my session crashed, Progress fix it. They're not going to be able to, are they? We're going to give them a fighting chance as well. So because I was able to give them the code for my unit tests, they could reproduce it straight away. And actually, it showed some bad coding on my part. Who's use the finally block. Have you ever returned a value in the finally block?
Yes.
Bad.
Very bad.
Very bad. Because it overrides error handling. Completely. Which I didn't know at the time. And the only reason that I found it is because I was trying to return a long char in the finally block. It returned nothing. all of the data types it returned. And when I asked people about this, they gave me a big smack. You shouldn't be doing that. So it's a good thing. Both sides learn from this. So don't use return in the final. Bad thing. Very bad thing. Recursive delete of a directory fails if one of your paths in the folder begins with a dot. I don't know why. It just doesn't.
Windows.
It might be Windows. I'm not going to. If you had comments in a JSON data string and tried to parse it, it didn't barf. It didn't. It just sat there and decided to eat 170 CPU and sleep at the progress session. So don't put comments in the JSON button. And this is a bit more difficult because static properties and method calls as part of a parameter cause GPF now. Finding that sort of thing would have been almost impossible in the run application running in production, because the clients would just say, my session crashed. And again, it was because I was calling a static method within a dynamic, within a method call. And the advice is don't do that. I mean, it is a bug, it has been fixed, but at least the benefits of the TDD helped find all of these. We only found 2 bugs a day. And one of them wasn't a bug, although someone told me it was. I didn't think it was a bug, because I just didn't put the functionality in. So it was bad spec. And I tried to blame the guy who wrote the spec, and that was me. And some custom properties, part of code generation, we can define extra properties in the class. And it tried assigning those custom properties to a database table when it didn't exist. There were more bugs found in the UI than anything else. We don't have unit tests for the UI. It's much more difficult to do that. Which should encourage you to write more of your code into your business logic, your methods. Take it out of the UI. Make the UI as code-free as possible. Put everything you can into methods or persistent procedures that you can test, because then you can fake the UI by passing information into the unit test. And again, you might not be able to see that entirely, but what that says is, if not property has is DB field then return. Now that's some JSON code to say, if my property object doesn't have a field called isDBField, then return. Likely, I don't want to write that buffer. What's the bug in that? There's one line of code with what, 5 tokens, and there's a bug in it. What if property does have isDBField, and there's no? I don't want to write the code because it is a DB field. But I'm only checking to see if it doesn't have the property in it at all. I'm not checking the Boolean value of that property. So even the most simple lines of code can have bugs in them, and quite horrendous bugs and far-reaching bugs. And unit tests help us find that. So there's some real big-time downsides here. Big-time in investment, much more complexity, and it's much harder than you think. You have to sell it to managers, you have to sell it to developers, and you will lose a title of hacker. You just can't be a hacker if you're writing unit tests, because that's very mainstream, very boring. So sorry guys, you lose the hacker title. However, you achieve much better status, because your code is cool, because it works, it doesn't fall over. So I've talked a bit about unit tests. I'm just going to give a quick overview of those. If we have enough time at the end of the session, I'll show you a couple of tests that we've done for our platform. A unit test should test one requirement of one method. Your tests should be as small as possible for each big thing that you're testing. There's no point writing a test that does a bazillion things, because it will say, I failed. Well, gee, thanks. Well, write a test for one requirement, write a test for one particular business thing. Isolation. A test should not rely on the results of another test. Very, very important lesson to learn there. Because what if that first test doesn't do what you expect it to do? It returns some erroneous data that you think is now correct. And you use that data to run this other test. Hey, everything works, everything's brilliant, everything passes. No, if the first test wasn't written right, your second test probably will fail, or should fail.
So what do you do about state?
You have special methods in the test framework that you can say, before every test starts, before my test class starts, do this. Before every method starts, do this. So you can reconstruct the state from scratch. It's pain. So we're talking about, what about state? In other words, let's say I want to test that customer number one exists in the database. Well, you have to find that record somehow. So the best thing to do would be to create a new sports database at the beginning of the whole test suite, and then load the customer into the database, and then test that way. And then at the end of the test, remove it or delete the database. Do not run tests on your production database. It's not a good idea. And you certainly should not keep a test database around for test after test after test. Because let's say one of your tests is to make sure that a customer exists, and one of your other tests creates that customer, your second test will pass. Now, maybe your second test should have created a customer, but because it already existed, it didn't need to. So your methods are flawed because that record already exists. So your state is very important in terms of making sure it's a clean start. Isolation from other developers. Yeah, make sure other people aren't running the same tests on the same database at the same time. Because you might be running some tests, and if you've set up a server on this database, another developer might be running his tests. And his tests are updating some data here that you're trying to read. Guess what's going to happen? You're going to have a bad time, because sometimes it will pass, sometimes it will fail. So when you're running unit tests on Mondays, it's all green. Tuesdays is red, Wednesdays is green. Thursday is red, Friday is green. So you think, oh, there's a pattern here. The compiler doesn't like Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's not the case. Peter's coming in on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and he's running something, which makes your tests. So I'm always blaming Peter. Make them targeted, repeatable, and predictable. Your tests should always do the same thing. There's no point changing your test to do something different. It fails, I'll fix it. Fix the code, not your test. It should return 42. Ugh. I'll say it returns 43. I'll do the example at the end. Just want to make sure that we get through. So let's just go over some ideas how to get good design. Writing tests means that you have to describe what you want to achieve before you write the code. You have to have clear in your mind or in a piece of paper what you need to do. In order to keep tests understandable and maintainable, keep them as short as possible. Long tests imply that the thing under test is too complicated. It doesn't matter if you have 20 methods in a class. It's better to have 20 methods that you can test rather than one method that contains all 20 stuff, because you can separate it out. And again, if a component requires too many dependencies, in other words, if this unit that you're testing has to have this and this and this and this and this working before it'll even start up, it's too tightly coupled. There's something wrong with the design of the application, because you need to be able to test a lot of things in discrete chunks. And again, that requires a huge amount of investment in thought to try and design the right APIs.
what if the thing that you're writing really only has one or two external methods, but the thing itself is something like a Sachs reader?
Then, first of all, your state is your data. So again, you should always test with the same Sachs method. If you then have a bug that you find with another set of data, write a second test with that bit of the data. You should know that that bit fails and that bit's fine. So you'd write two tests to start off with to cater for the change in state or data. The other thing, one of the ideas of unit tests or TDD is that you only test public methods. Because your public method is your black box. If everything else is private, this is a black box. So when you put stuff in, you should get stuff out. And that should be predictable and repeatable. So you write your test for that. If inside that you do all sorts of things that might break that output, you'll know fast enough. I went down the route initially of making everything public so I could test everything, which then meant, oh, blimey, I need to rely on this. And that didn't work. There was a nasty little trick, which I don't know if this is a bug in progress, so I haven't reported it because I'm relying on it. If you declare a method protected, now Peter will tell me whether this is legal or not. In a class, you define the method as protected, which means obviously you can't run it from a unit test. Yeah, because it's protected. You can define a class that inherits that class and overload the method and call it public.
Yep.
Is that legal?
Yep.
So that's one way of exposing protected.
Is it right?
I don't know. No, it's horrible. It's wrong. But yeah, it's possible. I would say that you should only test your public methods. So in the case of persistent procedures, you should look at what procedures are meant to be private if you haven't declared the private keyword, and so on and so forth. Yeah?
Having done this recently, it's an inherently complex task.
Yes.
So it's hard to think what a simple test is for.
The simple test is passing predictable data that you know either... You can write a test that you know is going to fail, because that's a good thing. Because if you pass bad data in, you expect it to fail. And if you pass bad data into a JSON parse and the thing goes, yeah, fine, there's something seriously wrong there, because it shouldn't. So you can write tests to make sure things fail. So in that case, you have bad Sachs, bad XML or good XML, and test good or bad results. So code design...
It's a better test than a successful test.
Then most of my code fails, and that's good. So code design to help with TDD, solid. We've come into all these principles just now. Code smell. You guys are good developers. You know when you're looking at a piece of code, you're going... And half the time is, we should fix this. But everyone looks at it and thinks, hell no, Johnny did that 12 years ago. No one has any idea why that bit of code works, and I am not going to change it. Because I am not going to be the one responsible.
I won't even look at it. Just frighten it away and break.
Yes. But you can look at that code and it smells. It's wrong. And obviously refactoring to help things better. So solid becomes a little bit more techie in object-oriented terms. But basically, what you should try and do is make each method do as little as possible, make have a single responsibility. Don't make a method create a directory, open a file, do this, do that, write some records to the database, modify this, modify that, maybe delete the directory and move on. Because you might, your directory creation program might have a whole heap of business logic behind it. You might be creating it based on the customer name. And that's a great case for making that a library call. Split it out, because then other parts can use it. You'll stop your repeating yourself.
It sounds like this works better if you're creating new code, like you said, as opposed to calling legacy code.
The comment is, it sounds like it's much better to write new code with this.
Yes.
It's going to be hard to put it into production code that's not being written with these principles in mind. It is. However, you can start making small things. Like, if there's a bug in one of your programs, you can write a test to find that bug. And then just start building up your library bit by bit. Obviously, writing OO code makes that a lot easier because you can substitute things in and out. So I'm not going to go too much into the substitution principle, but basically, you should be able to replace any class if you code to what's called interfaces. You should be able to return or replace any class with another class of the same interface and not break anything. And again, you must not rely on interfaces that a client doesn't need. One of the great things Scrubs put into 11 was multiple inheritance, or multiple implementation as well. So you can implement more than one interface, which is really cool. So you can define an interface with these two methods, or these two methods, and these two methods. So you only have the six methods defined for that interface, rather than having to have a whole set of things in there that just don't make any sense. So this is what we're talking about, interfaces and stuff like that. I read most of this in a book called TDD in Action or something like that. And a lot of it applies to C#, but a huge amount of it also can be applied to the 4GL. So, code smell. Mistakes. Repeated mistakes. Duplicate code, big classes, huge methods. Controversial thing here, and I've run past a few people, I'm not entirely sure myself, but there is a school of thought that says if you have comments in your code, it's too damn difficult to read. Because you're trying to explain what it's doing. Yep. It's one of those things where you think, hey, interesting enough, I had a look, because I knew I'd written a large set of comments for one address lookup program. In the UK, we have a special address system, which is quite special. And our postcode can be manipulated in several different ways, like 20 different ways. It means 20 different things. You can have three letters and two and four letters that means something different. And I'd written a huge set of comments because I'd gone through this pain and I'd documented it. And when I looked at it, my comments were 95% of the code. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, because it obviously means the code I was writing was far too complicated to understand. You know, I was saying if substring this comma 2, comma 3 begins B and there's not a space after that. Now, there must have been a better way of writing it by maybe making it more meaningful variable names or something like that, which we'll come on to. Too many if-then or case statements?
I was just going to comment on the comments.
Sorry?
I was just going to comment on the comments. I think I absolutely agree with the code should be understandable, but sometimes you have the overall business process is complex.
Yeah.
So therefore, you're putting comments in, not that necessarily explain the code, but just say, okay, at this point, I've now ruled out A, B, C, D, and E, and F is my only other choice, so that's how I'm here doing F now.
If that's code that's already there, I'd agree. So if you're writing new code, your specifications and your tests would show you that, because they've been refactored into various different methods. I'm not saying I'm sold on this, it's one of those things. My code has comments. It's what I can say, but I'm just putting an alternative point. What my code doesn't have is commented out code. Do not comment code. It's terrible. Your reasons for changing should be there. Your version control should tell you why it's changed. I know there's some stuff in there. Too many if-then-else statements means your code flows all over the place. If you go if-then-else, 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 you're not going to stand a chance of fixing that if something's wrong. Even if you indent the comments, indent the if-then-elses. Now, here's a math lesson for you. We all know what this code should do. And not one of you is going to go, I know. getting a value of A and B, and I'm returning A times P times C. Now, if there is someone in here who knows this formula, you are uber geeks, okay? So no one, does anyone know what it does? Sorry? The geeks in the back have it.
You have to figure in both sides. Sorry.
It's the same functionality. It's the same code. I don't need to comment that code, whereas I would have needed to comment the other one. So you can help yourself. It doesn't matter how long your method names are. It doesn't matter how long your variables are or your code to what the requirements are by writing code that describes what you're doing. It makes a hell of a difference. And I think it's a good example of how you can actually make things much better. So for code refactoring, extracting methods and interfaces and stuff like that, basically it means that if I'm calling something or I'm repeating my code, extract it, put it into a method, and then call that method from where you extracted it from, because it will make your code much more maintainable. We talked about multiple implementation of interfaces. Encapsulation of properties, this is getting far too geeky for me. Make sure that things are... it's just better code. Just write better code. Please. Conditionals with polymorphism. If you've got things that say, if this class is this, then do that. If this class is that, then do this. If this class... You can write overloads and polymorphisms to make that a lot better.
No, it isn't better.
It's like the modern version of include class.
You told us not to use those.
I don't know.
Yeah. So compile substitution that you got it.
Code which is complicated is bad design, hard to maintain, hard to test, and expensive to fix. As developers, you don't care, do you? That it's expensive. But your managers do, your bosses do, the company does. And if you're spending all your time fixing bugs, you're not doing cool stuff. You're not playing. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to take that Friday afternoon and just do something different, learn something new? But if you're fixing bugs, you can't. So, write better code. So, testing smells. How do we know that our tests are bad? Writing tests after writing code. Bad, bad boys. Don't do that. Not writing tests? It's a pretty bad smell. Again, duplicate logic in tests. If you're duplicating code, you need to refactor your tests even. And try as much as possible not to have code in your tests. When I say code, I mean if then else's and all that sort of stuff. You should really just write test, test, test. Because if you write code in your tests, there is more than a 90% likelihood of you having a bug in your test, which is quite scary. Because your bug in your test might say that your test passes. So ship it, and you have the bugs. If you're removing tests, oh, I've got 1,000 tests, 999 pass, I've got one that's red, I'll take it out. Not a good thing. Changing your tests to pass is not a good thing. Fix your code, don't fix your tests. And we've talked about the dependent on another one. Multiple asserts per test. Now, an assert is one of the unit testing to say I'm asserting or I'm making sure that this is right. Again, try not to have multiple asserts per test. Write two tests instead of two asserts, because it makes it easier to run through some things. Try and increase your code coverage. Get people to review tests. You write a test, you review it, because you can see. You should be able to look at what this person's doing and understand what he's doing without actually being told what to do. Manually introduce a bug. Yes, you will. But if you manually introduce a bug, you know, like our test returns 42, well, that's it. If you deliberately put some bug in your code and all your tests pass, there's something wrong with your tests. But you know that you've introduced this bug, so it's not the same as trying to find a bug. You know that there's a bad thing in there. And we've talked about writing tests first and making your tests isolated as much as possible. Don't check in code where you have red. Because what will happen is some other port bugger will pull that from the version control system and have your bugs in it. You know there's a bug in this. Have some pride. Don't check in bad code. Now, integration tests are a whole different other thing. I'm not going to get into integration tests that mean, you know, this module works for that module. That's not unit tests. That's not test-driven development. That's a whole separate thing. This is your UAT and everything like that. We talked about testing in republics, if possible. There are sometimes some reason to fake in test some of the bits and pieces. And we talked about the setup methods earlier. These set of methods are run every time a test is run. Make tests readable rather than maintainable. If you can read what the test is doing, it's better than having a nice test that you don't know what it's doing. Yes. Talk about isolation and clean up and set up its own state. It should be repeatable. The test should do the same thing every time. It shouldn't be a random thing in this. It should be a binary, yes or no. And use variables instead of constants to make tests readable. So I've got my test hash one here. Yes, you can have the hashes. Define data as char. Data is geocode, get GPS, Maitland, South End. Yeah, I'm asserting it's not null or empty. I'm checking to see I get a result back. But I don't actually know what Maitland is or Southend is. What if I've got those the wrong way around? It would be better to write a little bit more code and call it town and building. And then your code says get GPS building town. So you know what you're passing in, you know what you're testing. So this is declaring extra code instead of constants, yeah, but it makes your tests much more readable.
Wouldn't it be better if you actually tested what you knew the answer was supposed to be, instead of just not null?
No, that's my one test. My next test would be to make sure I got the right constants. So that you, I mean, really what that should say is get the GPS coordinates for a building or town, ensuring it's not null or blank. But you can see that's a long method name. But you know exactly what it's doing.
But all you're doing is, I mean, so for the fish, would you have other assertions in that test?
Yes. I wouldn't have other assertions in this test. I'd have another test.
Okay, I would think that makes
sense. Did the test be a single method that's running a specific?
A test should run a single thing.
Well, I guess the test name doesn't match with your assertion.
That's what I was just saying.
Oh, okay.
I should have really renamed that to make it even longer.
Then your next test has to be good.
But that's where you start refactoring. Because you'd call a method that returns the right variables. And use them. Yes, there's often code duplication in tests. You should try and refactor it as much as possible. But the whole point of tests, if you're trying to set up state, you're probably going to have some duplication. It's not perfect. So yeah, we're saying talk about name tests, preprocessors, interfacing to facilitate tests. This is starting to get into some really complicated stuff where instead of for each customer reading from a database, it gets it from a temporary table, and that becomes a lot more interesting, I should say. So our code is readable, it's maintainable, it's trustworthy. And that's the important thing, our code is trustworthy. The Art of Unit Testing by Ray Oshura it's available on Amazon, it's a great read.
Really?
I'm very sad about this. It is a great read. It explains an awful lot of stuff. There's some stuff in there I don't agree with, but that's just me. But I would recommend that you get that and read it to introduce you to this sort of thing. So I think we've got about 5 minutes left. Where are we?
Any on that time?
3:15.
3:15. I'm out of time, aren't I? Yes, Peter.
In order to get the customer, a whole heap of things had to have happened first. How do you get in there in the first place? And how do you leave there? So yeah, when it comes to real world stuff, it does become a lot more complicated. But you've got to try and make this happen. You've got to try and make sure that even if you just start off by saying, right, I am going to find the first customer, and start that as your first test, and then think, how did I get that customer? How did he get into the database? And then write tests for that, or set up state, or whatever you want. Results. I turn the whole customer, MD5 it, and check the results. So
the requirement is get all customers as easy as possible. But so you can put a test on the outside.
Well, you say get all customers, how many? One, 10, what kind of?
So there's that. But there's a single entry point to that block key that you test around.
Yep.
So take that as given. Now, that's fine, but that's a big problem of stuff in the testing. It's, as you say, finding the customers, checking your security. How do you map the tests? Do you just go by tests on what you think map to the original requirements?
You write tests to the specs, your requirements.
We just make is give me a customer. So for a login using it, we will give me n customers.
For a login, that's one test. You need to test the login. Yeah, there's a whole series of stuff here. And is the user a super user? Do they have access to that table? So there's a whole heap of other things that you can do as part of that. As I said, one of the things that I do to test huge data sets or stuff like that, the sports database as is comes with a fixed set of data, with a fixed set of records that haven't changed if you do a ProDB on it. So your state could be setting up ProDB, creating a query, pushing them all into a temp table, create the JSON string from that, MD5 it, store the MD5 as part of your test, and then your unit test can just say, does the MD5 match my result? So it encompasses a whole heap of complications, but if the end result is exactly the same, you're pretty good. Yes, Tom? This is a hard time.
You spent 3 weeks redoing my app.
Yeah.
How many tests have you written?
How many tests have I written? I'm glad you showed me that because I have code to show you. I mean, I can give demos of this code once we've out of there. I've created a separate project called, but you might not be able to see that. I'll expand this. But anyway, in my test suite, I have builder, active record. So I have all those in there, I have all those in there, all those in there. And I have things like expectations. So what I say is, I'm expecting to get this result from something else. So rather than trying to put that in code, I load this in and test them as well. So that's I have it in core. I have JSON, I have scaffolding, I have utils. So I have more tests than code.
Yeah.
Basically.
You're talking about thousands, tens of thousands, or millions?
Couple hundred.
Couple
This is not a big project, but yet you will have boatloads, boatloads of tests. And yeah, it's hard. It really is hard work.
So, quick question. Looking at applications being on happy paths, you know, if the user's giving you requirements, you're working on the problem, the requirements are always happy paths. ITS, they're not happy paths. So, database now, time now. Do you add those in the unit testing? Do you add, but it's very hard for a whole bunch of developers to ask the DBA to turn the database off, for example. Could you write that number of tests?
But you'd have your own DBA. You'd have your own DB for testing.
You'd write that level of testing.
And then check the test out. And yeah. Shut the database down. One of your tests would be disconnect my DB and then run the program.
And locking timeouts are again hard to recreate, but that level of testing you include as well.
Well, locking timeouts can be relatively easy because you can run a procedure that locks a certain record. With a share lock or something.
You're thinking that way. You have to do
that. You have to think that, yeah.
Yeah, you have to start with the error test, the alerting, you know, is my level of two support getting an alert because, yep. You know, all that stuff.
Emails.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we're out of time. As I said, I'm around if anyone wants anything, but thank you.